This event is presented by the Council on Foreign Relations.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for joining us. We have an amazing panel today. Three of the most accomplished, distinguished people who I know in healthcare in general, and certainly digital healthcare. And I'll introduce them first, starting with Dr. Cheryl Pegus. Dr. Pegus is Walmart's Executive Vice President of Health and Wellness. She is developing Walmart's healthcare vision. She joins from Cambia Health Solutions, where she was President of Consumer Health Solutions and Chief Medical Officer. She's practiced in private practice as a cardiologist. She's worked for Pfizer and Aetna and been the first Chief Medical Officer of Walgreens. And she's the co-founder of A New Beat, an organization dedicated to improving cardiovascular health and careers of women and underrepresented minorities. She's on the board of the American Heart Association and the immediate past board chair of the Association of Black Cardiologists. She received her bachelor's from Brandeis, her medical degree from Cornell, and her public health degree from Columbia. Moving on to Rand Balasar. Dr. Balasar is a public health physician, manager, and researcher. He's the director of health policy planning at Clalit, Israel's largest healthcare organization. He's founding director of their research institute, a WHO collaborating center, and does strategic planning and development for organization-wide interventions to improve healthcare policy and quality, reduce disparities, increase effectiveness, and introduce data-driven tools into practice. He got his medical degree from Tel Aviv University and his PhD in healthcare management and a master's in public health from Ben-Gurion University. He's professor and track director in the MPH program at Ben-Gurion and has written more than 150 peer-reviewed publications focusing on use of databases to improve health and policy, applying and assessing innovative models of care. He serves on many advisory groups for the World Health Organization and is chair of the Israeli Society for Quality in Healthcare. He's also a council member of the International Federation on Medical Informatics and the International Foundation for Integrated Care. And last, but certainly not least, Dr. Farzad Mastashari is co-founder and CEO of Aledade. He spent his career at the forefront of healthcare policy and health information technology. He's the former national coordinator for health IT in the US and served as distinguished expert at the Brookings Institute's Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform. He founded the New York City Primary Care Information Project, which equipped more than 1,500 physicians in underserved communities with electronic health records. He's written and spoken extensively on issues of healthcare IT, accountable care organizations, and published quite widely. He received his MD from the Yale School of Medicine, master's in population health from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We have an amazing panel. And we're talking about something that people are really excited about, which is the future of digital technology, the future of health IT. Now, I come to this as a public health physician. I focus on population health and how can we get the most health for the most people. And I break that down into fairly simple things. How do we improve access? How do we improve quality? And how do we make sure that we do that in a way that's affordable so that more people can get good health? So let's start with the issue of access. What can and can't digital technology do to promote access to healthcare? And maybe we'll start with who would like to start?
Cheryl.
Thanks for that volunteer nod. And so I think digital technology helps in access in a couple of different ways. One, you've got to know where to go to receive care. And I think many times we start out thinking about care of, well, is it a decision of, do you have health insurance? It's actually more than that. It's also is what I'm experiencing with the heartburn, is that something that I'm deciding to go to the emergency room because I think I'm having a heart attack? Or is it something that I think I can treat at home myself? Or can I make an appointment to see a primary care physician? So when you think of digital, It's a way to allow you to make decisions of the right site of care. And so digital tools really matter in that forum. The important piece of this, and the way I look at it, is that it's digital that allows you to triage to a human if needed. And so if it is that you've looked at it and you've answered specific questions, be it from an algorithm that's available, and it says, based on your risk factors or your particular situation, we'd like you to connect to a clinician. And by the way, I'll use the word clinician broadly, it doesn't always have to be a physician, that it allows you to do that. It saves money in you going to an emergency room. It saves time, particularly if you're caring for your family on a Sunday night and you now have a place to resolve that. And it also saves the ability for you to feel as if you're learning of how to manage and self-manage your own care based on the ways we've made care health illiterate. So completely believe that there's a role, particularly at the front end, in allowing people to be empowered to make the right choices. If we're playing telephone, I'll send it over to Fazad.
Thank you, Cheryl. So at Allidaid, we're focused on all three of those, cost and quality starts with access. And in particular for us, as Cheryl talked about, it starts with access to primary care. And what we found was, yes, telehealth can be very important, but more important than telehealth for us has been telephone, actually fixing telephone has been the most important thing, and in both directions. So what happens when a patient calls? Do they even know to call their primary care practice? Are they able to get in to be seen that day? And that was just enabling that was a huge cultural change, workflow change, and yes, required technology change. Can you schedule yourself for an appointment online? Can an emergency room get you in to see your primary care physician the next morning? Those are all access points. And one of the first things we found is we needed to change the answering machine messages and the insanity of like where you can't actually reach somebody if you're calling the practice, much less calling the practice at noon, right? Like no one picks up the phone at noon in your average primary care office. The second was outbound. So we always think of access as when the patient says, oh, I need to go see somebody. But actually what we need to do for population health is to reverse that. And someone needs to call you. And we're seeing this with COVID now. The people who are going to sit there and refresh have gotten their vaccine. The people who are left need to be called. Someone's got to call them and bring them in and pull them in. And that is access too. We can't be passive when it comes to access.
Rand?
So, you know, in Israel, I think that we have the unique situation in which the main focus is really on general practice more than anything else. Not on specialty, not on hospital care. Most of the money, some of the best paychecks actually go to general practice in the sense of family practice. And because it is, in my view, you know, in the combination of public health and population health, the only type of medicine that on the mass scale can actually transform the quality of care that you provide to your patients, especially with chronic disease and multiple chronic diseases on the long term. And so we are fortunate enough under those settings to have every one of our patients have their own GP with a specific amount of patients that he cares for and he knows and he has access to. And access to your GP generally is within 24 hours, except, you know, unique cases. And so we, in that sense, had the access figured out on many of these scales. That being said, there's always the overnight and there's the weekends and there's all of the other aspects where the telecare and telemedicine have made a huge quantum leap in increasing access just in time for those patients to get the type of care that they need. And we've been doing this for over a decade, providing our patients with access Telecare started with pediatrician online, then went to family physicians online, and then went onwards. And then came COVID-19, and everything basically became digital. So I think that in the essence of where we put most of our efforts in terms of digitization, the key was more to focus on improving quality. We had access in many essence pretty much figured out.
So we've heard three really exciting things. First, that digital is important because it facilitates connection with a human being, from Cheryl. Second, that there's a really exciting technology that can transform healthcare. Alexander Graham Bell would be very proud. It's the telephone. And third, that you really have to have a primary healthcare system in place if you want to start addressing quality issues. Now, I'll do a retroactive advertisement. A week or two ago, we did a workshop here at CFR about the politics of primary healthcare. And we spoke with leaders from Thailand from Costa Rica about how it came to be that primary healthcare ended up being politically popular in those countries, because that's generally not the case in most countries. And we've struggled in the US to get political salience to primary healthcare. We might get back to that later and learn from Ran what led to that change in Israel. But let's move on to the question of quality. And let me be really blunt here. The US does a terrible job. It really does. Now, you can make excuses. You can say it's social determinants. It's the pervasive racism in our society. It's the disparities. And if you look at, you know, rich areas, they do pretty well. But really, I don't buy it. Because many years ago, Farzad and I were in my office as we were implementing electronic health records throughout New York City in Bed-Stuy, Harlem, and Central Brooklyn. And we asked this really dumb question, which was, how can you save the most lives through healthcare? And we both looked at each other blankly and said, we don't know. So we sent some graduate student off to do a lit search, 10 million articles at that time in Medline, not one answering this question, not one. So we had to do the analysis ourselves, and turns out far and away it's hypertension control. And even in the years since that analysis, that result is much stronger than it was then, because the value of primary prevention with aspirin is much lower, and because the SPRINT findings and the epidemiologic findings show that lower is better in terms of hypertension. So if you want to solve for the simple question, how do we save the most lives in healthcare? The answer is improve hypertension control. And yet, despite enormous effort in the US, the Million Hearts campaign, we had weekly meetings with the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. We had the entire department involved. We were able to move the needle from 54% control to 44% control. We moved the needle in the wrong direction. And this really emphasized to me that something fundamentally is not right when we pay $4 trillion and we can't get the single most important thing right even half the time in the US. So quality, how can digital technology help us with quality? Let me start with Ran, because you've got a very different environment there and maybe kind of an optimal location to be thinking about how digital technologies, and I know you've done a lot with population health. So Ran?
So I think the first most important point would be to kind of disillusion us from the thought that digitization will solve anything. You take a broken, misguided process, you digitize it, and you get a digitized, misguided, broken process that is likely more expensive and is more likely to channel the funds in the way that that it was intended. So I kind of want us, first of all, to understand that the key thing in digital transformation is the transformation, not the digitization. You first have to map how you want the process to look like and then ask whether digitization might really allow this to happen and whether the entire system is incentivized to go there and whether the work process can accept that. Eventually, the most important of any intervention process in healthcare is workflow engineering. at the end of the day, this needs to make sense to the exceedingly busy practitioner that's working far more than they should, and they have zero tolerance to anything that would not fit their workflows. And in many instances, some of the digitization processes try to push down their throat this new gizmo that's supposed to make things better, either for the patient, but usually actually for the system. And they will probably resist in many different ways, very, very creative ways. So workflow engineering, I think, is a key thing to take into account. And the things that worked best was when we worked with the frontline workers to design the process. And at the very end of the road came in the digitization. And I will give a few examples later on, but I want to give the others a chance to relate.
I know, let me just turn to Farzad, because this must be music to your ears. I understand the two of you have never actually spoken before, but everything you said could have been verbatim from Farzad based on our past conversations. But I do want to share one thing from our own work at Resolve to Save Lives, where we're working around the world to improve hypertension control. We've built a small app to empower nurses to manage hypertension, patients with hypertension and diabetes. And the design team, which is fantastic, went to them. And the main thing the nurses said was, don't make our lives harder. Our lives are already really hard. Please don't make them harder. And that was essentially the mantra. That was the dictum of the design team. And so they designed a system that has now 700,000 patients on it and takes 18 seconds for all of the follow-up information to be added. And it's something that's kind of almost a joy to use, you can say, and provides real value for the health workers. Farzad?
Yeah, I was going to say, Ron, I loved everything you said. Let me make it, give a real example, though. In Mississippi, in the Mississippi Delta, we work with a network of federally qualified health centers, community health centers. And their blood pressure control rate was not 55% or 65%. It was 79%. So it can be done. And we're still not satisfied. And we're now looking at racial disparities in severe uncontrolled blood pressure. And even despite all the work we've done, they persist. So we're by no means done, but we rely on the information technology. If the information was stored on paper, there's no chance that we would be able to put in place the new workflows that we do put in place. So the technology is not sufficient, but it's necessary if you really want to be able to do this population health at scale. And so, Tom, I think we maybe had a slight misdiagnosis, but you need single agent therapy doesn't work. You need double or triple agent therapy against this scourge.
Cheryl?
So I'll say a couple of things, because I think Ron's first point is important. Don't design solutions for people without asking them what solutions they need or can use. And it's not just for physicians, but it's actually for consumers and people as well. And so Farzad brought up just the high rates of disparity in hypertension in particularly African-American populations. And by the way, if you look at the data, that population actually sees their physicians incredibly regularly. Mm. The high blood pressure is almost ignored. And so there's a piece here of how do you flag that hypertension, if we use technology within that care setting, is a high risk condition. We have to help do that. So I think we've talked a little bit here of how do we incentivize the right behaviors. And so this is Medicare data, right? It doesn't show that people aren't seeking care. So that's the first thing that, by the way, here's what normal blood pressure is, and anyone you're seeing over the next 5 years who has the same number and is on the same drug, there should be some feedback loop about here's what you're not doing correctly. The second piece that I would say is that for hypertension in particular, there's some of this, you know, Tom, you mentioned using nurses. There's a lot of this that does not require a physician to help manage. And there is, for those of you who follow just literature from the past year, some of the best hypertension control studies that have been done are called the barbershop studies. And they were done in barbershops because it's an environment that is trusted. It's in an environment that allows you to use digital tools. And so you're able to do ambulatory blood pressure measures, but you get to talk about what contributes to high blood pressure in a culturally appropriate manner that allows you to talk about diet, talk about exercise. And to today, and I know Fazad and Tom, you're feeling like you failed, those studies, though the original studies were actually done by the Association of Black Cardiologists, those studies to today still stand the test of time. And when they come back, they really speak to this team-based approach to care, care being in your community setting, utilizing community health workers, pharmacists, and others to do that. And at Walmart, you know, we've just started our clinic, our primary care centers, and we've started with community health workers as a key component of that care team. And moving from a community health worker to then a care coordinator, to then a pharmacist, to then a nurse, to then a physician, it not only lowers cost in the system overall, but the ability to relate to the people in your community because you're from that community and they trust you. We're actually seeing some really great improvements in things like blood pressure and in diet. And I think our approach has to be tech-enabled, but human-centered, and continue to stress that that's what success will look like.
So Cheryl, you bring up the idea of team-based care, which I've always thought of as a win on so many fronts. You end up with better care because it follows the protocols better. It's more accessible to patients. It employs more people and it's more cost effective. So everyone is practicing at the top of their license. What's the role of technology in promoting team-based care? Farzad, what's your experience? Or Cheryl, if you want to start.
No, I was just going to say, you know, it's interesting. And Fazad's going to dig in on this. I'm going to set it up for him. It's about the incentives. That's what allows you to utilize team-based care. And I say that to say no one gets up to not do the best quality job that they can. And I believe that. And I believe that particularly in healthcare. It's how do we help you make those choices to what Ron started saying in a very busy day, in a very busy schedule. Those are the types of strategic leadership opportunities that we've got to utilize to allow a physician to say, you know, I know you're going to go get your prescriptions here, and I may not know as much about all of your other meds. You should have a conversation with your pharmacist. We don't yet utilize the opportunity to even embed that team-based training early on. So everyone feels like the handoff is occurring. And then what you get back into your electronic database allows you to then make the next right decision. And now I will pass it to Fazad.
The technology, obviously, communication, healthcare and medicine is about information. It's an information sport, and communication is vital. And when you don't have it, when one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing, the patient suffers. You can't coordinate care. But to follow up on Cheryl, when we want to say, oh, let's give this service to the patient, it can be a pharmacist, it can be a behavioral health expert, it could be a psychiatrist, it could be substance abuse counselor, it could be a social worker, the number one question that stops us is, can someone get paid for that? And that's just a lousy way, right? And you know, what we're paying for is literally people sit there and calculate how many minutes of someone at what salary level, right? And so you're literally hard coding the incentives in the system where you get paid the most if it's the highest paid person doing the work. So guess what? Now we have high paid physicians doing work that they don't need to be doing, right? Because that's the payment system that creates those incentives. And I think when you see systems like Kaiser Permanente's, when you see systems like Ron's, where they are really taking full advantage of team-based care, it's where they can say, I don't care. Like, I'm getting paid a set amount for this person, and I can do group visits, individual phone visits, nurse visits, home visit, right? I don't care how who provides the service, as long as we provide the service. So that to me is the two keys, right? Is we need a payment system that incentivizes total health, and then we need the technology to be able to enable that. And again, like, these are almost co-equal. But technology is necessary and can be transformative in the right context.
Ren?
So I'll start by saying that I don't think that we've really deciphered how digital health would transform the issue of teamwork. I could say that what we know for sure by now is that there is no chance of treating a multimorbid patient properly for the long term without that taking place. And so what you need to get is a true interest of everybody involved to get the patient well-balanced and overall with good outcomes. And then once you have some training to all of the relevant staff of all the different professions and to have them at the right place at the right time to be able to work together, it should happen. What, for instance, you know, when we try to kind of review the literature on what kind of programs actually made a difference in multimorbid patients that actually transformed their care and were able to keep them balanced for the long term and reduce costs, the single word that was repeated in every one of the studies that have shown actual success, the one word that was repeated was the word nurse. Not a specialist, it was, if you had a nurse-led program or an embedded program with true teamwork, with a tandem of a physician and a nurse working together, it worked. If it didn't, it did not. And so we can use, and we are using some of this to allow them to have each one have their meetings with the patient and share some of the notes and some of the daily life schedules of the patient that were performed, that were done with him, and share them one with the other. That makes life much easier to make that happen. And that's where digital health comes to play. But I think the most important thing is to understand that this kind of work needs to be done, that the patient cannot, you know, the basic facts of multimorbid life is that you have nothing to eat, right? If you have diabetes, and just to take one example, if you have diabetes and heart failure and a chronic kidney disease, which this combination exists in about one third of the CHF patients, okay? So my question to you is, what can they eat? We can go ingredient by ingredient. Sugar, no, right? Diabetes. Protein, no. Water, not so much. CHF, not so good. Salt, also an issue. I can go on. You will see that if somebody needs to abide to all of these, they have nothing to eat. And let alone the medication they get that completely negate each other and can go on and on. Without teamwork, this will fail.
So a note that next Wednesday, May 12th, is International Nurses Day. And nurses are the essence of good care in so many systems, if they're part of a team and are empowered to be running things. I learned how to take care of tuberculosis from a nurse who had done it for years and knew exactly how to treat people. I was an infectious disease fellow. I knew nothing compared to Ms. Pearl Branch, who had been doing it for 30 years in a TB clinic. So what we've heard is that incentives are enormously important, and not just incentives in the sense of some quality incentive, but actually the structure of incentives for a system, the approach to capitation. I want to handle two other issues, and then we'll open it up for questions more broadly. The first, going to Rand first, the use of digital technologies for surveillance, for epidemiology, in COVID, for predictive analytics. I think you're really at the border of showing where what the future may look like in a system that's joined up and electronic.
Thank you. I do think that we've had the chance in the last decade or so to try and experiment with many ways of using predictive medicine in practice. And you know, because we have this integrated data sets that allows us to create cohorts, retrospective cohorts, and create predictive models, you can actually, for every single patient, try to say what will be their exacerbations, what will be their future illnesses year by year, in 5 years from now, in 3 years from now, and use it in order to approach them proactively. So the key thing about prediction is what you do with that, and it should be the move from reactive to proactive care. And if you're able to do that, then it's really transformative. So in preventing kidney disease, that's the easiest example. It's easy to identify patients that will have kidney disease 5 years from now. And the changes you need to make right now in order to change this, their path is pretty simple. So we did this and we saw amazing reductions in kidney disease on the longer term. We now did this for about 10 different chronic illnesses using putting the predictions into practice. And the latest thing we've put in is a whole platform that allows the physician to see all of the different patients he needs to proactively care for and then rank them according to the need. Who do you want to see first and what do you want to deal with first? So you can actually, again, put it into your work practice and do the right things right first time and by the right ranking. So that's on the potential benefits. But there's perils coming with that. And we need to take that into account. One of the biggest problems that we have right now in healthcare everywhere is overdiagnosis and overtreatment. The choosing wisely thing is something that we're not talking about enough. And there is a strong risk when you use predictive medicine, especially with sensors, that you will begin seeing a horde of unneeded therapy and diagnostics and tagging of patients with diseases or pseudo diseases that would have nothing to do with their outcomes. You will start overtreating them and you will make a bad situation even worse. So the issue of pretest probability and the actual benefit the patient, the number needed to treat and number needed to harm, should be guiding us more and more in the future, because it sounds really sexy to have all of these gadgets send all this information in and you do something that looks futuristic and you actually just add futile care on the good side, but in many instances, detrimental care that would actually reduce the level of health the patient has.
Farzan, briefly.
So Ron is talking about a system where clinical data and administrative data can be brought together and seeing the tremendous power for understanding the world, understanding what's happening, understanding the patient, of combining those two. In the United States, we have very few systems, certainly not half of the population the way it is in Israel or more. But what we have now is we have collaborations between, for example, Cheryl when she was at Cambia and our group of primary care providers, where we were able to combine their data, their administrative and payment claim systems, and our data, the deep clinical laboratory medical information that we had. And we are able to create extraordinary better predictions in this example, and to do surveillance. So I'll just say I don't think we can replicate Ron's system exactly, but it is actually, once payers and providers come on the same side of the table and share that information and combine that information, we are seeing extraordinary results from that.
Cheryl?
And that value, the ability to see what that complete value can be that you can take out of the data, is really important. I would also say there's an interoperability component here in ensuring that data is getting to the people who actually need to use the data. There's a little bit of, there's great data, but it's hoarded somewhere in the back And the person who is actually providing the care may not know that you now got two or three drugs added on. And this is not just because of our EMRs. There's a bit here of how do you take good pharmacy data and make sure that it's brought to the forefront. And it's a huge missed opportunity, right? Everything, if we're talking about quality, it's about adherence. It's about drug-drug interactions. And it's about understanding the cost component of this. And so if you are treating patients and you're providing great care and you've picked what you think is a wonderful drug and they can't afford it or it's not on their formulary, we've all done everything we thought was great until they get to one of my 5,000 pharmacies. And now that's where the solution solving for how to improve care is actually occurring. And so we've got to bring that in front end. And I would say, right, I will own the fact, I did not train well in pharmacology. I actually need help in being able to do this right. And we're not always, even though we're giving information to groups like Aledade, we're not always saying to them, and here's the cost. Ask the last time someone writing a prescription knew the cost of that treatment. And so we leave that to individuals to go solve on their own. Those front end technology pieces, we don't think about it as quality, but they are absolutely key. And we must make it part of the answer as we take care of populations. And so interoperability, data to the right person, and what's the right pieces of data that you need to be successful in improving outcomes.
Before we open it up, I want to talk about money. Because we've talked about how incentives are really important and they're not well aligned in the US system. They're not aligned to maximize health. We've got a big industry now built up around the poorly structured system we have in the US. So how can the private sector contribute to health improvement? Not just leveraging some aspect of our reimbursement system or capturing some part of savings, but actually, how can the private sector help Americans live longer, healthier lives? Cheryl, I'm going to put you on the spot.
No, I'm okay starting with that. So you raised this a little bit earlier. So what's good health? What makes up good health? 40% of that is social determinants. I think I might have shared, 20% of that is personal behaviors. And we've been talking about that a little bit. By the way, and the data, somewhere between 20 and 25, that's where clinical care falls. We spend a lot of our money there, but that's where that falls. And then there are all the other environmental genetic components. So how do we begin to solve this? I think you look at, are we ensuring that there is just fresh food? Rand talked about this, right? When you think of multi-morbid populations, just fresh, healthy food, accessible and affordable. And why aren't we writing prescriptions for that? Fazad has known me for a while. I think you walk into a place like a Walmart and you hear that we are the largest producer of fresh, healthy food in the country and at the lowest cost. And I think, forget cardiology. I'm just going to write prescriptions for fresh food and get it delivered to you, because that's what we need to address. And how do we ensure that it's not just 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, but it's Saturday and Sunday evenings, and it's at night that you've got a place to go to get healthcare? That's how we address it. Access matters. Fresh, healthy, affordable solutions that you have to self-manage also matters. And then the third piece of it is making sure that you're in the right place to do this, because healthcare remains local. It's not just technology that helps you to reach populations where you're not. It's when you need to reach out to someone, technology helped guide you to that local place that's available anytime that you need it. And I know we're going back and forth about technology. We absolutely need technology to succeed. We just need more of it. And then we need to understand how we use the humans within the healthcare ecosystem to have the technology help them be better every day, not drained and overburdened, but better every day. And that's the charge, I think, for many of us we're excited about. So I'm the techno-optimist.
Farzad, and then Ran.
So you said, how can the private sector, what's the role of the private sector in creating health? And I've been speaking to folks in the administration and also journalists who are increasingly concerned about the role of private equity in healthcare. And you can see why when you look at what happened with surprise billing, and whenever there's some sort of loophole or arbitrage opportunity, then like literally that's in a way like what capital does, right? Capital will go to where it can create returns. And using those arbitrage, but that's short term. And the job of the policymaker is to align private profit with public good. And my advice, when people say like, oh, you've been around Washington, like how do you, what would you advise us? Is this thing going to be changed? Is risk adjustment going to be, fixed, so that we don't have as much arbitrage? I'm like, what would you do? Like, assume the policymaker is A, smart, and B, wants the best thing for the country, right? Assume those two things, then eventually they're going to do the right thing. And if your calculus is, how can I get in and get out before like the gig is up? That's not a great, I don't think that's a great use of capital for your own returns. But on the other hand, if you understand that the policymaker wants to get better care, higher quality, more access at lower cost, and if you can put capital to work making that happen, like then you got nothing to worry about because all the regulatory and policy doors are going to open in your direction instead of against you. And I think we're now seeing more and more people who have access to, who have a responsibility to increasing their capital returns saying, is there anywhere in healthcare where it's not a game? It's not a gaming thing. It's not an arbitrage thing. It's not a, it's actually aligned with societal benefit. And I believe in those double bottom lines.
Ran, very different system. Any perspectives?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine how different it is. And indeed, just for those who don't know it particularly well, the care in Israel is public. All of the care is provided by four health organizations. It's universal healthcare. You get your GP services for free. You get your medications for almost free because there's a cap on everything. And there's even an additional cap when you have chronic diseases. And so when you go to a hospital, it's generally free. Forget surprise.
Stop showing off, Ren.
That's why the question is difficult. Not only does now surprise bills, there's no bills. That makes it a little difficult for me to address. But I have to say that, every healthcare system is broken. That's a fact. And in different ways, according to the problems and incentives and the way it was misbuilt layer by layer, which always creates a lot of overwork and very little benefit. And I think that at the end of the day, what really some of these innovations can do is try to fix a lot of that in many different ways. One is to help make it possible to have fewer and fewer of our ailments and needs to be addressed by a physician, because of empowering the patient is the biggest change that will happen to healthcare. There's so many things that are driven towards the physician and nurse that can be fixed with decision support on the personal level, because it's not rocket science. I'm sorry, I mean, we're all physicians in this call and we have a lot of respect to our profession, but so much of what we do is just plain simple checklists and flow charts that can be followed by almost anyone. And by putting this into the handheld device of the patient, we can free him in so many instances. And that would be a huge, I think, tremendous change that would affect every health system, regardless of the incentives and misincentives that characterize it.
All right, Carrie, can we go to the audience and you can repeat the instructions and we'll hear the questions.
We'll take our first question from Reynold Barrett. Please accept the unmute now button.
I believe I did. The question that I would ask, you spoke about compensation and also the collaboration among different providers. We know that many healthcare workers, especially pharmacists, have in the last 20 to 30 years have been educated at a much higher level of expertise. But there is no insurance model for compensating them for their service, therefore we underutilize them. And we have enough data that says that the local pharmacy sometimes is the important point of contact, especially if connected with other practitioners. What are the impediments that prevent us from actually creating the valid compensation models, especially now that in COVID, through the pandemic, we've learned the significance of access to the pharmacy and the pharmacy as delivery point.
I can take a step of that. Dr. Verrett, you're in Louisiana? We have a group of health centers.
Yes, Louisiana.
Yes, we have a group of health centers and private practice physicians who are using now pharmacists quite effectively. And what made that possible was a payment model where if we were able to prevent hospitalizations, we and the primary care docs and the pharmacists and the health centers got to keep a portion of those averted costs from the hospitalization. And it turns out hospitalization is so darn expensive that you can pay for a lot of pharmacist time and a lot of primary care time if you orient the incentives, reorient the incentives that way. And so I think a lot of the discussions around reimbursement historically has been, can we pay this group or that group for this service or that service, fee for service? And I think Dr. Pagus would say that when you're on the payer side, everyone says like, oh, if you pay more for this, it'll cost you less, but few are willing to actually guarantee it. And I think what we need is to move in the direction of that skin in the game, that guarantee, that being at risk with the payer and say, if you pay for this, we'll guarantee it. We'll be on the hook for this. If costs go up, we'll pay you. If costs go down, then and only then would we accept payment.
I would just add on to that. And so there are two pieces to this. One is absolutely how you structure the payment model, because it's not just how do you include a pharmacist, it's other care workers onto this team. And when your contracting model allows you to do that, by the way, you know, we haven't talked about burnout, but even burnout goes down in those practices when you know who the rest of the members of your team is. So it's that piece of ensuring that that type of value-based contracting continues to grow in our country. And I think we've learned a lot, and I'm hoping those learnings persist when we look at COVID-19 and how the ecosystem of pharmacists and other types of healthcare professionals really were able to provide care. But it's not just payment. There are also state regulations that have to be addressed in how we allow different healthcare professionals to perform at the top of their license. And there are some states that are further ahead than others that allow pharmacists to prescribe or to care for populations or to do a diabetes prevention program. It's not consistent. And those are the areas that we have to work on. So there's a policy as well as a payment component to this. And technology, by the way, enables this. And so I don't want to lose that. It allows you to know and stratify who are the people who you should just let the pharmacist manage. And there have been great studies on a number of cardiac conditions that show management just by pharmacists produce great results. So this isn't a question of good quality care. It's can we align these two other roadblocks, regulatory policy, as well as payment models to allow us to continue to use that talent and skill.
Great. Carrie, can we go to the next question?
We'll take our next question from Janine Bursey.
Hi, my name is Janine Bursey. I am the co-founder and COO of a women's health startup called Electra Health. We help women navigate the menopause transition, 5 to 10 years of their lives, with interventions in that midlife phase that have implications for good health in later decades, the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. And my question is, as an early stage innovative company, the question of how to sell into the healthcare system, you know, is often direct to consumer or to health systems or to employers. And there's been so much discussion of fatigue among employers in particular, as, you know, HR teams are not necessarily trained to be managing health benefits for different vertical slices of the healthcare experience. And so I was just curious if this group had any thoughts or comments that might pertain to how, you know, innovative companies that are entering the space might go about reaching those populations.
Either Farzad or Cheryl or both of you.
So I'll kick off on this because it's an important question. So there are a couple of things, right? There's first, is there a demand for the solution and services? And have you demonstrated that? Because you first got to say, here is the target market that we're trying to reach. And we know, we've heard from them that they deserve and need more care solutions. And we've also looked at what's out there today and know we've got a better offering. So you first have to make sure that you're standing out in the offerings that you have. The second piece of this is, what is it you're trying to solve? Because if it's that you're trying to solve a consumer solution offering, you might start with the payer in looking at, are they looking to provide more solutions to their members? And is this a solution that fits into that for them? The other group that, when you're at this early stage, is also to look just directly at large employers, self-insured employers, to see, again, are they trying to help their employees solve a problem or a solution? Part of the reason you start in those two places is you've got to build data and some outcomes to say that your solutions work. And for health systems and providers, they need that proof to say that, yes, we're going to integrate it into our care ecosystem, and here's how that fits in. Along the way, as you build all of these relationships, the real important piece is to continue to collect your data on your ROI and results, not just in care, but in being able to lower costs, because investments today are asking for both. And your technology, just to stay on the theme of this meeting, is how is technology making it easier, either for your end user consumer or for the people who have to integrate it into what they already do, to see this as an opportunity for them. And so a couple of different points to really bring home, but the important ones that allow you to get some stickiness and allow you to enter some of these ecosystems.
Was that anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, I would just say the fact that in the, and everyone's probably thinking like, what? Like employer? What does that have to do with health insurance? The fact that we have tied, you know, health benefits and employment together, and then we ask our, you know, human resources and benefits people to, you know, figure out how to pay for healthcare and so forth. Like, that makes no sense. And I think we are not seeing the same sort of innovation in the self-insured employer space as we are seeing in government programs, Medicare Advantage in particular, or even in fully insured commercial populations. They're, you know, only slightly below Medicaid in terms of the innovation that we're seeing on the on payment reform and delivery reform with self-insured employers, because that's not their business. And so I agree with Cheryl that working with the payers is if you can, you know, do that, is might help this thing scale. With employers, you can often get a foot in the door, but you can't get it to scale, and it's just tough.
Hey, Carrie, I think we have time for one more quick question.
Take our last question from Eddie Fishman.
Thanks so much. My name is Eddie Fishman, and I lead health access transportation at VIA. I have a question that actually pertains to what we was just discussed. You know, we have seen so much advantage or so much innovation in Medicare Advantage and other sort of capitated models where you could actually go at risk. What is the key to actually getting some of those models put into the biggest share of the market, which is, you know, of course, employer-sponsored health insurance? Is it, do we need policy reform, or is it there's something the private sector can do without policy reform to make that happen?
Farzad, Cheryl, anything you want to say briefly?
You know,
we're going to go one last round.
Haven was going to try to do that, and you know, it didn't work because they couldn't get through the TPA barrier, the carriers, the ASO. And I think what we need is we need a 2.0 kind of TPA that really sells on the basis of value and cost corridors, not on the basis of fake discounts off of fake prices.
Cheryl, anything you want to add?
Can't follow that. I think that's captured.
Okay, so now we've got just 2 or 3 minutes, and I want to ask each of you, if you could change one thing that would allow digital technologies to result in substantial improvements in health, what would it be? I think, Farzad, you've got an answer here, so we'll start with you and then go to Cheryl and end up with Ram.
You would think that I would have my ready answer, but I think it's for, and I'm going to aim at my comments at maybe the new administration. I think it's to nail the, you know, hammer the nail all the way in when it comes to interoperability. Hmm. It's been 10 years. We've made a lot of good steps on the technical side, on the policy side, on the payment side. And there's just a bunch of stuff that's like almost there and just needs to be hammered in all the way in terms of information sharing being the expectation.
I thought you were going to say capitation.
That's Cheryl. Happening definitely.
And so I would say you hear a lot that you can't do good digital health if you don't have broadband. And you can't do, and you can't do. And I think Farzad started this by saying telephone is also a tool. Smartphone access is also a tool. Let us not start with what we can't do. First, let's optimize what we can, see what our measures and success are, and then learn and build upon. But we've got tools today to use. I do think we've got to maximize them. They're important. People need them. And if we start there, it allows us to then change, pivot, and see what else is newly needed. And I think we as leaders have to take that approach, else we'll just keep sitting around saying, oh, there's more that we need to do to get started. It's no, we've started. How do we measure and continue and then build upon?
Great points. Thank you. Ren?
I think that maybe before we invent something new, we should make sure we use what we already have. And so our key problem is adherence, usability, and the joy of life of using whatever we have right now. Currently, in too many instances, the technology, especially in the offices of the physicians, make them miserable. And it doesn't have to be this way. So I think this is something we can work to make, you know, digital appliances could be fun. It should happen in the physician offices as well, and actually help them do their work better. And I think that would be a great change from the current status quo.
Start with what we have available, make it fun and enjoyable to do, and make it interoperable. On that note, back over to you, Carrie, and thanks to all three of you for a terrific conversation. I've certainly learned from it. I hope our participants have as well. Thank you.
For more event audio, subscribe on iTunes or visit us at cfr.org.